Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Johannes. My paper will be referring to you, and in a sense is inspired by a lot of Johannes's work. So I'm happy to have been able to speak after him. So I am going to be very badly behaved and indulge in a bit of longue durée intellectual history in relation to India. I want to tell a story, as it were, about the development of a particular approach to inference in India and the way in which, for certain schools, inference becomes the prompt for thinking about the divine as the ground for inferential induction particularly, but the way in which this turns into an abduction. So the first part of my story of Indian history is going to relate to the classical period and what I've argued is kind of a discovery of inference that happens at a crucial grounding moment in Indian history. The second part of my story is going to jump forward to the medieval period and the scholastic dimension. And there I want to look at the way in which that initial idea about the place of inference and the desire abductively to try and reason towards a ground for those inferences takes a lot of theologians in the tradition I'm looking at back toward a desire to try and understand how logic informs our very concept of a ground, to come up with a ground that is, in effect, logically structured, and therefore a notion of divinity that is, in effect, logically structured. So it's kind of the god of the philosophers, but as Johannes has pointed out, we don't have gods in Indian philosophy necessarily, so it's an extended exploration of how divinity functions as ground. So, an early classical Indian text from the middle of the first millennium BCE, the Aitareya Upanishad, accords to knowledge a cosmologically basic world-grounding status. It tells us that knowledge, I quote, is the eye of all. And on knowledge, all is founded. Knowledge is the eye of the world, and knowledge is the world's foundation. In this paper, I'm going to try and do two things. Firstly, to try to see how the kinds of knowledge delivered by inference were taken by early Indian thinkers to reveal the ground of the world, inspiring India's own god of the philosophers. And here, Bronkhorst's language and reality paradigm will be augmented with what I'm going to talk about as a not so much a correspondence principle debate, but a sign and ground, or appearances and ground of appearances debate that I think shaped the way that Indian schools developed their own religious metaphysics out of fundamental logical insights. And the second thing I want to do then, this is the second part of the story, is to look at the way in which a particular definition of identity as a limiting or exclusionary semantic condition, something called an upadhi, that amongst other people, Stephen Phillips here has written extensively on, how that concept gets used in the Vedanta tradition of sort of religious metaphysics to inspire an account of divinity as something that is itself made up of a kind of fabric of logic. Now, some years ago, Johannes Bronkhorst boldly revolutionized approaches to Indian philosophical history by foregrounding one of the key philosophical puzzles through which Indian thought developed, and you've outlined some of that today. He sketched a drama in which generations of thinkers from across India's diverse religious orientations, and as we've seen, there are many, of course, and yet large swathes of them question the apparently, both explored and question the apparently natural correspondence of language and reality. And in the wake of that, as we've seen, doubts about the legitimacy of language's grasp on things never really went away in India. Skepticism, in a sense, is there from the beginning in a way that is, I think, different from the sense in which Europe moved towards it. Bronkhorst's language and reality paradigm hovers in the background of the history that I'm going to try and tell today. But here we look at another theme that shaped Hindu notions of the divine in particular. I argue that alongside the language and reality debate, there was an associated appearance and ground debate, directly related to those religious thinkers who wanted to reason toward some sort of divine ground of things. In the Vedanta school particularly, so a well-known school of metaphysics we've heard about, Samkhya, another school that we've heard about, and the Vaisheshika schools of metaphysics, so all of these fall within the Brahmanical category that we've heard about. In all of these schools, inference plays a unique part in positing a property positioning ground, and I'll explain more of what I mean by this. Anyone who's worked on substance substantialism, the Aristotelian heritage of thinking about substance in the West, knows that substance as a ground of properties, as a ground of things, is a highly contested idea. It's a very problematic notion. Philosophers, and for that matter, physicists today, are trying to interrogate whether or not it makes sense to talk about some fundamental grounding fabric. Find where I was. So that theme is something that comes into question in those schools. Inference helps them to lead towards a notion of substance. In some cases, it does call what we often translate as substance. Vaisheshika calls it vastu, the thing to which properties inhere, the thing which engages in actions. Others call it Brahman, and this is where we get the Vedantic approach. Brahman, I think, helpfully, almost literally, can be translated as the ground, that which bears up the appearances of the world. And others called it a kind of procreative material that takes on different forms. Samkhya called it Prakriti. Nevertheless, so where these language and reality debates were prompted by the intuition of a naturalistic correspondence between words and things, what we might call the appearance and ground debates were prompted by the sense that the apparent coherence of phenomenal signs in the world, the apparent coherence of the appearances that we see in an everyday world that enable us to make inductive leaps logically, is itself something that requires the reasoning to an underlying causal ground that is the basis of continuity. This intuition produces the different Indian metaphysical systems that framed reality in different ways according to the system of sortal concepts that they applied to appearances. So what's interesting is, and I'll go into this in more detail with regard to classical thinkers, but for each of the groups that wants to posit a ground for the inferences that we make from the appearances around us in the world, so a ground for induction, something that explains its legitimacy, the way that it works, each applies a different notion to what it is that those appearances are. And the concept that is used in that logic for each of those groups, the sortal concept that it employs in dividing appearance into individual entities, then determines how they proceed to posit ontology as a ground for those things. Schools that characterized appearances as events tended to produce a processual ground, a process ontology. Schools that interpreted appearance as properties of a substrate produced a substance and property style of ground or ontology. And schools that interpret appearances eidetically as conceptual forms tended to produce a semantic ground, and that's what we're going to be looking at. Indeed, the proliferation of different interpretations of phenomenal signs that we find across different Indian schools is quite striking. I've argued elsewhere that it leads the Vedantic tradition almost to function, India generally, but the Vedantic tradition in particular, to function almost as a kind of a generator of multiple ontologies. In what follows, we'll trace the history of this approach to inferential grounding and look at one particularly nuanced approach that self-reflexively reads the logical basis of inference back into the ground that it posits as its causal basis. But first, some general comments on the significance of logic in metaphysics and in religion. Looking at the typical syllabus for a course in logic today, it's all too easy to forget that logic was, in the beginning, religious, in the West at least. For Pythagoras students, his discovery of number as a distinct form of being opened up access to eternal truths that seemed to partake in a divine realm. Only there could the qualities of eternity and necessity, sovereignty and timelessness be found. Only numbers are wholly themselves eidetically simple in a way that does not change, in a way that's very different from any of the identities that we find in the world around us. Only numbers can have in fact, the transcendental qualities that later came to be associated with the divine in Christian, Muslim, and Jewish theological traditions, the classic transcendental qualities by which God was defined: eternity, immutability, incorporeality, simplicity, necessity, sovereign non-dependence. Pythagoras the mathematician and Plato the reasoner, we must remember, were cultic thinkers and Gnostics, whose ultimate goal was to transmute the bodily human realm into the unbodily realm of pure number. For Plato, this was part of the religious project of demonstrating a purely ideal level underpinning reality. And it's no mistake that in the Phaedo he argues that the soul is actually an idea, a concept, the idea of life, and as such partakes in the qualities of immortality. Logic, whether expressed through number or language, was part of a metaphysical reality more fundamental than that which we see every day. But, this is relevant, I think, for the kind of deconstruction that we see in the Indian tradition. But at the same time, it's useful to note that Plato himself came to question and revise the topology of that reality of number, of concept, of logic in his later works. The Parmenides questions whether the logical realm is a space in which ideas exist as reified things. The Republic, of course, uses analogies that makes identities, concepts, forms, universals appear discrete, eternal, and distinct from other identities. But the Parmenides questions this and depicts them more as a web of ideas in which identities exist as nodes. The reification of concepts was, of course, the center of centuries-wide critique from Indian traditions of Buddhism, Advaita Vedanta, and elsewhere. And this is, I think, what we see when Plato and the Parmenides, he has this wonderful scene where he says, take a tall man and a short man. We can see them instantiating two clearly distinct universals, tallness and shortness. And then he has this typically cheeky Platonic way of saying, but what if we introduce a taller man into the room? We have suddenly lost tallness. Tallness has become shortness. Can tallness be shortness? Surely they are intrinsically distinct, and yet suddenly tallness has become relationally redefined according to the web of ideas that seems to underpin this. And if one's interested, of course, there are those who argue that Plato had a later mature doctrine that was only transmitted via his students such as Aristotle, and the quote-unquote hidden doctrine. But some argue that that has particular links to the way in which he tries to disrupt his own sense of the determinacy of the forms. So I think just as Plato is questioning, if you like, the discrete character of logic and identity, so too we find something similar going on in the Indian context. And I'll be arguing that a particular semantic metaphysics based on Upadhi theories assimilated these sorts of critiques. So another way in which the critical approach to identity becomes very much assimilated into a new form of metaphysics. And particularly the Satkaryavada theory that we heard of from Samkhya, in which effects exist in the cause, forms a kind of a bridge from a more crude notion of identities as discrete to a more refined view of them as internally complex, naturally mercurial. So just to look at some of the earlier sources that we find in the Indian context. Now, generally, logical and metaphysical reasoning are seen as fairly separate in their methods and claims. Logic, of course, is a priori. It takes us to necessary truths. Metaphysical reasoning is associated with a posteriori truths, with contingencies. It builds pictures of the world rather than analyzing them for their continuity, their consistency, and coherence. And of the two, it's usually metaphysics that seems most naturally allied with religion. Logic tests doctrines or helps to develop them, but the doctrines concerning the world are usually decided within the metaphysical sphere. Central to the two spheres is the distinction between deductive and inductive inference. And indeed, there's also, of course, the third category of outsider, if you like, category of abductive inference, something that was developed particularly by Charles Peirce. I notice there's another paper later in the conference on this topic. Abduction, of course, argues that not only can we generalize from what we see in the world, not only can we deductively analyze its underlying constituent conceptual character, see its entailments, map out its nature, but we can also abductively reason, if you like, backwards towards explanatory models, explanatory causes that then add to the picture we have. Peirce notes that, in fact, abduction is the only kind of, if you like, inference of logic that imaginatively, speculatively adds new factors in to the ideas that we're working with. And it seems to be an abduction that we get the development of metaphysics out of the inferential observations that we make about the world. Inference is interesting. It turns predictive induction which simply tells us what we will see next, what we can see elsewhere, into explanatory theories. It's the point at which metaphysics emerges, if you like, from logic. Now, I've tried in a recent book to show the way in which early classical India discovers inference and plunders its metaphysical model-making qualities. Inference has already received considerable attention in relation to the history of logic in India, of course, particularly in relation to the Nyaya tradition, to specifically the methodological tradition of logical analysis that arises in what's called Nyaya. Extensive attention is given to it in this context, but relatively little attention has been given to inference in relation to the development of metaphysics and indeed of religious ideas. So here it's useful to look at a different set of early sources from the Nyaya logical ones that are usually given attention. These suggest a perhaps parallel tradition of meta-reflection on logical reasoning, or perhaps a parallel root of these ideas, particularly with regard to Vedanta, a school of thought in which the divine is primarily designated as the source and ground of the world. While its ideas took on many expressions over the centuries, there are many different forms of Vedanta, many different ways of defining the divine as a universal ground. Nevertheless, it shares this underlying key idea. At its root lies this god of the philosophers, a divinity divined in terms of sacred ground. And it becomes firmly established in various ways, not only through the Upanishads and the statements within them, so these early classical texts, the Upanishads, in which we get almost like the pre-Socratics, a number of different fragmentary indications of the ways in which we may define the divine, but also when the Upanishads are then formalized into the Brahma Sutras, we find particular lines that mean that because we already saw a Brahma Sutra Bhashya here, every scholastic theologian who returns to try and develop a new conception of the divine will have to address this particular notion of the divine as a ground of the appearances that we see in the world. So through this exegetic train, the continuing notion of a kind of philosophical inferential god is carried on through the tradition that then succeeds it. It is a divine from which things are born or become. So Brahma Sutra verse 112 says, Brahman, the ground, is that from which things arise, that from which things are born, janma. The question is how to gain knowledge about that origin of everything, about its status as a material as well as an efficient cause. What kind of reasoning can reveal that ground? Now, the knowledge of that reality is ascribed to a special type of secondary knowledge in very early sources. The Mundaka Upanishad characterizes a rather mysterious kind of knowledge. This is a very early text, and people have argued that we find an early theory of knowledge in these sources. So two kinds of knowledge are listed. A character asks in this text, "What is it, my lord, by knowing which a man comes to know the whole world?" The motivating force of the discussion is that a knowledge of everything is desired. A knowledge that will prepare us, as it were, for all the different appearances that we can see beyond the immediate sense data that we have present. And it lists two levels of knowledge. One is a lower knowledge consisting in sciences such as phonetics, ritual instructions, grammar, etymology, metrics, and astronomy. We can imagine there are lots of Brahmins sitting around going, "My knowledge is the one that will tell us about the world. My science is the one." But it then goes on to describe a higher knowledge, which it says reveals an explanatory, invisible layer of reality. There are two types of knowledge a man should learn. The higher is that by which one grasps the imperishable, what cannot be seen, what cannot be grasped, that which is without color, without sight or hearing, without hands or feet, what is eternal and all-pervading, extremely minute, but present everywhere. That is what we wish to perceive. Now, passages like this are usually interpreted in a kind of mystical way. But I think it's important to see that they're often allied with specifically philosophical instructions about the way in which inference can take us to a deeper understanding of things. The Taittiriya Upanishad speaks of a kind of knowledge that involves large-scale combinations, mahasamdha, in which we are able to acquire knowledge of lots of different things and combine them into a larger, overarching, and coherent understanding. And perhaps one of the most famous cases is that of the Chandogya Upanishad. In this particular text, Tima has noted that we seem to see, genuinely, a theory of inference, a rumor of indirect synthetic knowledge which finds expression in the first lines of the sixth chapter. This is quite a famous passage that becomes the basis for a lot of future reflection on the nature of the divine. Here, a priestly father named Udalaka Aruni teaches his son about an adesha, a kind of special indication, by which his son can achieve far-ranging indirect knowledge that far exceeds what Russell would have called the direct intuition through the senses. The text cites the lesson. The father says, "You must surely have asked about the indication by which one hears what has not been heard before, thinks of what has not been thought of before, and perceives what has not been perceived before." And the poor son responds to this, you know, thinking, "God, I thought I was just going to school so I could learn how to do rituals that would get me cows and wealth and immortality. I didn't know I was expected to acquire intense spiritual, in fact, philosophical language." The son says, "No, I have no idea what you're talking about." He says, "How indeed does that indication work, sir?" And the father replies, "It is like this, son. By means of just one lump of clay, one would perceive everything made of clay. The transformation is a verbal handle, a name, while the reality is just this, it's clay. That, son, is how this rule of substitution works. That's how this indication works." Now, the passage does a number of interesting things, but among them, it suggests that formally similar things probably have an underlying shared cause that accounts for the consistency of their appearing. Right? Actually, moving from the pot to the clay is a kind of an abductive leap backwards to assuming there is some shared underlying constitutive material. And we can see that with pots and clay. But what's about to happen is the text wants to apply this to the notion that for all forms in the world, we can similarly assume that there is an underlying causal substrate which supports and gives rise to them. The second thing it does, it seeks an explanation of the cause then. Using the analogy of clay, it suggests that it is a material cause, making them part of a shared identity, giving causal force that underpins the inferences that we can make across our experience of the world. The initial promise is that an inductive method exists which will facilitate generalized indirect knowledge, outstripping the data of the senses. Okay. The Chandogya goes on in the next sections to apply this model to the diverse appearances that constitute the perceived universe. If the ground of pots is clay, then the ground of phenomena is a foundation of Brahman that the text is ready to attribute divine qualities. Now, this is a prime site for early Vedantic Upanishadic inference. But the next citing is in the Samkhya Karaka, which we've already heard about today, which is the root text of the broadly concurrent but quite different Samkhya school of metaphysics. The Samkhya Karaka also gives a little account of inference here, and it explicitly gives it now a name, anumana, literally something like thinking again, having seen something, seeing it again, thinking again, making an inferential connection. Here it's offered as a tool for deriving subtle, sukshma realities as opposed to observed ones. So inferred realities, generalities, universalities are described as subtle realities rather than sort of concrete ones. It provides a threefold breakdown of inference. It relies on the sign that we see in the world, the possessor of that sign, i.e. the underlying substrate, and the precedent, which we've seen in the past, to derive the notion that there must be an underlying ground, and that ground, of course, it calls prakriti. So here, too, we find a small instance of a theory of knowledge based on inference, and here again, abductively, inference is providing the notion of an underlying foundation of the phenomenal world. In the Samkhya Karaka, that foundation is not accorded divine qualities. In fact, they're quite practical, quite sensible, and they say, look, whatever it is, it seems to, in its association with these qualities, change, transform, be in a state of constant flow, almost Heraclitean nature, which seems subject to intrinsic change. So we do not want to call it divine qualities. And the Indians, like the Westerners, were obsessed with qualities of immutability, eternity, non-dependence, non-contingency, and intrinsic necessity, which would seem to make it very separate from the outer world. But we find something similar going on in other sources as well. So here, while they're using the ground positing force of inference to argue for a single material cause of all things, we can see something similar going on in the case of the Vaisheshika school. The Vaisheshika school's approach was in many ways more extraordinary, for it effectively posits an inference grounding reality, but performs a constitutive analysis of the very conceptual apparatus involved in the notion of a ground. In its sortal categories, it comes up with seven basic types of things that exist in reality. So it's often seen as something that does not say there's a basic ground of everything. It's got a sevenfold ontology. Those seven things are substances, properties, actions, universals, particulars, and inherence relations. Very odd list of kinds of things that the world seems to consist of. Notice here that universals, particulars, and inherence relations are things, basic ontological categories. And therefore, the aspects of an inference fall out as follows. Phenomena are sorted into properties and actions. The continuous ground that combines and orders them into distinct identities that pins them down to particular things is sorted into the category of a substance. And notice that substance here does function as a ground for reality because they point out that all the other categories cannot actually exist unless they are attached to a substance. So in fact, the substance has to fulfill that inference grounding role at the beginning. But still, it's divided things up. So the phenomena take the role of properties and actions. A continuous unification is served by the notion of substance. The analytic category of particularity explains the context-specific, unique character in which we discover phenomena happening in particular things, objects, and places. The category of universality explains the generalized character that enables induction to function in the first place. So I'm able to see that you're all humans because not only are these different properties united in particular instances by substances, they're also able to be united in general instances as universals. And the relationship of causal continuity provided by the substance is sorted into the category of inherence as a thing. So they are it's inherence relationships that bind them all together into these clusters. And later versions also brought in the notion of absence as something that shows what's happening when, in fact, inference fails, when, in fact, things do not appear, do not continue. Now, this fascinating ontology can be read as a kind of analytic breakdown of the features that underpin inference. Like Samkhya, it does not accord divine attributes to the ground in the sense of the substance or vastu that is necessary for these things to actually be instantiated. But it does accord divine status to the ground in the sense of that which underpins the continuity and coherence of appearing. Famously, the Vaisheshika school have a curious version of the teleological argument for the existence of God, because they say if the world is made up of all these different sorts of things, what is it that makes them unite together into a concrete world of different, well-ordered things? It must be God. So here, the ground is not that which substantially underpins them, it's that which gives them the coherence that we see in the outer world as a whole. So here, in a sense, we're also getting inference generate our notion of the divine. Now, these early sources seek to provide a firm, best-fit theory of an inference-supporting ground, the logical structure of which gives shape to the appearances that we see in the world around us. And we can find many different sources from the classical period that try to bring back a notion that what's really going on in our search for the divine is a search for something that will give coherence to the world we find around us. And here the word divine that I'm using is linked to this notion in which so many of them in this classical period, when looking for the basis of the coherence of the reality that we perceive, accord it, note that it has qualities. In some sense, ontological qualities that make it special in a way that for these thinkers is correlated with the divine. So just as Plato and Pythagoras are fascinated with the world of logic, so too here, the logical world is pointing towards qualities that people accord a special significance. Such knowledge is, according to the much repeated Upanishadic phrase, the eye of the world. And just Pierre Hadot's observation about the ancient Greeks and the ways in which philosophy for them functions as a kind of a spiritual exercise is relevant here. As Seneca sought to plunge oneself into the totality of the world, so these texts treat inference as what Pierre Hadot calls a spiritual conquest of space. I think Hadot says something happened in the classical period in which humans discovered that through philosophy they're able to transcend their particular context-bound, limited data set, if you like. And through inference, through philosophical truths, through logical, logically underpinned understandings, they're able to conquer the world, to transcend the bodily. And this is part of what's happening in these sources. Now, that's the beginning of the story. That's the first half of the story. That's what I would like to think of as a kind of a shared interest in signs or appearances and their relationship to ground as a kind of an underpinning of an intuition towards the divine and classical Indian thought. What I want to do now is look at what this means when you take it forward into the scholastic period. Because, as Johannes has already indicated, there are lots of difficulties that arise in the way that we deal with concepts, and particularly in the way that India had certain assumptions about the nature of those concepts. Was it at an early phase already inclined to question and to express skepticism about concepts as discrete and reliable things? So the various religious metaphysics that developed in Vedanta on the basis of abductive inference to an underlying cohering ground, each applied different concepts to the appearances, and we can see if we want to, we haven't got time here, but a whole range of different ontologies that arose out of it. I've argued that process ontologies, substantialisms, modal and dialectical ontologies can all be found thriving alongside each other in the Indian scholastic world. But now I want to look at one approach that noticed not only the curious miracle of inductive inference, but also took on the implications of deductive analysis. Okay, the difficult deduction is wonderful because it enables us to gain new knowledge. Not new, of course, famously, it's not really new knowledge, but to gain apparently new knowledge by digging into the entailments of a concept, discovering, laying open to view what is actually entailed in any particular idea or identity, and that's what deductive logic does for us. But of course, deduction can also, as we dig deeper into a concept, disrupt it, destabilize it, show its relation to other concepts, its underlying multiple constituents, the way in which it is perhaps not itself as coherent as we might initially think. So deductive analysis then helps to make them think deeper about the inference that they're deriving from appearance and the nature of ground that would have to give an explanation of those appearances. If the identities of the appearances themselves are complex, interrelated things, what does that mean for the ground? Now, skeptics about the natural correspondence of language and reality remained influential in India through the classical into the scholastic period. And certain perspectives, preeminently Advaita and many Buddhist schools of thought, question the logical coherence of identity. One of the first groups to open the way to a thoroughgoing critique of the idea of discrete phenomenal types, generalized as universals, was Samkhya, as we've seen, in the very moment that they argued that inference must lead one to posit a ground of appearances in Prakriti, in the Samkhya Karaka. They also, of course, in development of the Satkaryavada theory, noticed that appearances, that identities, are not typically coherent, distinct, and continuous. Identities are changing. They're mercurial and they're complex, if we look at them particularly chronologically over time. So in the same way that the West starts to think, as it reflects on the philosophy of change and the philosophy of identity towards endurantist, perdurantist, and four-dimensional theories of identity, i.e. ways of factoring in change over time into the notion of identity, and therefore have to question whether there is any such thing as an identity, as a particular discrete concept, so too we see this happening in the Indian tradition. As I've said, that's already kind of prefigured in Plato. So trees, persons, even pots, all change, so that the universal that we think we see there is destabilized by a succession of different properties. Does treeness have a single identity? Well, no. I mean, clearly it doesn't. Satkaryavada makes perfect sense in some ways. It's very difficult to tell whether we would want to say whether the acorn, the sapling, the oak, or indeed the log or the mulch is the tree. Plato would say, which bit of the tree's life was it most tree-full? And can we, in fact, find any stable identity here? So Satkaryavada, in a way like Aristotelian telos, magics up the assumption that things have a certain modal set of limits, an assumed set, literally in the mathematical sense of modes, within which each identity plays itself out. It's easier for them to have a Satkaryavada theory because they didn't want to follow through the assumption very deeply. So, you know, Satkaryavada says, I span the embryo and I span the corpse I'll one day be, and maybe even the ash at the end of the process, right? But how do we draw those limits? Why am, after the ash, why am I not the pleasant river into which I'll be poured? Why not the fish who accidentally eat me? I mean, you know, how do I, if we accept even a small version of a modal ontology, how can we not in the end accept a large version of a modal ontology? You can imagine if Satkaryavada had pursued their ideas further, they might have ended up with a kind of a Kripkean modalism. They didn't, which makes life easier for me. But it's interesting that that seems to be implied. And in some ways, this idea is already there in the Western tradition when Aristotle comes up with the notion of telos. Aristotle's notion of telos doesn't get very far, partly because it raises the same difficult questions. So Satkaryavada stood on the verge of something like a modern modalism that must acknowledge the near infinity of possible developments and thus of possible worlds. But it did not lead to a next stage. Instead, we see other things going on similarly in the Advaita school. In many ways, the Advaita's illusionistic, quote-unquote, questioning of identity does something similar. So famously, Shankara, who we've already heard about, develops the notion of adhyasa, superimposition, hermeneutic imposition of identities onto things. In a way, it's tantamount to saying, look, I don't know which bit of the tree is a tree. What I'm going to do is develop conventionally the notion of tree, which is obviously internally complex. It has soft edges, as it were. I'll call the sapling a tree. Not everyone would. I'll call the log old tree, no longer tree. I remember its association. I won't call the sawdust tree anymore. In a sense, if you read it this way, the adhyasa superimposition idea that we find central to Advaita thinking also acknowledges the notion that identities do not have any concrete and coherent sort of underpinning in the world. Interestingly, the strong version of the Advaita doctrine uses this notion of adhyasa superimposition, the notion of tree is wholly brought by me to this phenomenon. And in fact, there is no such thing corresponding to a tree there. It's completely arising out of my own fancy. But there's another version of that doctrine, which is less well known, which Shankara also in places argues for. Instead of adhyasa, he uses the notion of an upadhi, a limiting condition. And he says a limiting condition is an interesting idea. It's something like, in the Vedanta context, examples that are given are like in a room. In this room, there is lots of space. The space is one. If we pull out one of those dividers they sometimes use in conferences, we'll get three different rooms. Has the space changed? No, it has not, but our perception of it has changed. Take a landscape. The landscape does not change. If I put a fence around parts of it, it will now become, if I draw a line on the map, I'll have different countries. Now I'm in Poland, now I'm not. But has the land itself changed? Cognitively, I have imposed new identities onto it. Now, the upadhi idea is gentler because it does not say that the thing I've created with my mental cognitive imposition is completely false and illusionary. Instead, it says that this new thing that's been created does indeed represent the reality that's there, but it only does so selectively. It shows me a part of that reality. It imposes a contingent, cognitively useful way of seeing it. It's perfectly valid as long as I don't mistake my selective cognition for an accurate understanding of the whole. And when this is applied to the ground of reality, remember all of these doctrines apply to individual identities, but they also apply to the ground of all things and to all phenomena, then each of us becomes one particular manifestation of the infinite potential for something to have different qualities. If you like, Brahman or the ground is the landscape as a whole, we are particular designated, contingent, limited, selective identities which can be seen within it. Now, this is used by Shankara, and for purposes of time, I won't give detailed quotations of it. It already had been found in other contexts, so we can see particularly early cosmologies in which space is used. There's a curious text in which people talk about space as a kind of locus, adhisthana, or a framework in which time and space exist as upadhis. And what they seem to mean by space here is the framework of existence itself. if literally space here, dik, extension, and time, kala, the division of time into parts, are imposed upon an underlying framework that is able to support them, and those are only conditions or limited ways of understanding them, what does that imply about the underlying ground? So there's an earlier cosmological precedent. It's brought out by Shankara. But that idea also finds limitations in Shankara's writing. Shankara has a difficult relationship with the inferential sign ground or appearance ground motivation. He accepts the Upanishadic sources that lead him to want to see the ground of all things as that which underpins inference. And indeed, in arguing against Buddhists, he often makes this point. Buddhists say there is no continuity or coherence in the world, and Shankara says there is, and it is given by this ground which abductively we have discovered. But elsewhere, he does not want to do that. He does not want the divine, the ground, to be connected to the appearances we see in the world around us. Notice two fundamental underlying impulses here. One wants the divine, the ground, to explain the world, and indeed is happy to see it in connection with the world. The other wants the divine to explain the world, but is not happy to see it in connection with the world, does not want the appearances to, as it were, taint the underlying ground. And Shankara is of the later kind. He gets himself into some difficulties, in fact. So he has to argue for the notion of upadis. A scholar called Malkovsky gives a nice summary of Shankara's approach. He says, in Shankara's use of the notion, the relations that we see, the relation of properties that are brought together in each of you to define you as an entity, are merely extrinsic denominators, upadis of Brahman, which, while correctly indicating the true nature of Brahman to the world, do not indicate the absolute by its very underlying nature. They are what Thomas Aquinas would call merely logical relationships, says Malkovsky. The person who takes the notion further, and we find various versions of this, but one of the first is Shankara's main opponent, Bhaskara. Bhaskara is a Beda-Beda Vadin. And this is a particular school of philosophy that is happy to see the ground, the divine, as connected to the world. It's much more comfortable with the notion that the divine should be, in fact, affected by these appearances that we see around us. And he goes on and uses the same thing, but instead of what Shankara does, far from arguing that Brahman has no qualities and that the appearances are merely imposed upon it, merely selective visions of it, he argues that Brahman, the ground, must have all qualities. If something that is able selectively to be seen as all of us, if something's able to do that, it must itself have infinite qualities from which we select when we cognize it. Okay, Shankara has the difficulty of saying the ground has no qualities, but if you selectively see part of it, it suddenly appears to have qualities. And Bhaskara, the Beda-Beda Vadin, notices that that doesn't seem to make sense. You have to let the ground have all qualities so that you then are restricting it. Okay. So he says Brahman is an ocean of unsurpassable and immeasurable qualities proper to its nature and the abode of many kinds of finite formations. But it is conditioned by an upadi, and the upadi is the binding and releasing of the divine into different forms. So being, this is all relevant, I think, to what's happening when the West tries to get away from its substantialist notion of being and move towards something more like being as language, something more like a semantic conception of being. Brahman is essentially that ground of all potential and possible properties, qualities, actions, characterizable appearances that is bound and released. Other texts use the imagery of revealing and concealing. Again, if you're used to Heidegger, it's very appealing to make that connection to unconcealment. It's not the same thing, but there are similarities there. The ground is bound and released into the forms that we see, but it is, by definition, in the language that's used here, full, not empty. Transcendence, then, has to be redefined, not as an empty ground, but if it is, in fact, the ground of the appearances that we see in the world, it has to be a full ground, infinitely full, in fact. And the play of appearance that we see around us is merely a selective revealing and concealing of what is there. So Many texts then talk about the negative and the positive sides. Suddenly, negative concomitance, concealing, has a positive aspect to it, a creative aspect, in fact. Just as in Plato, the transcendentals must include separation, choresis, and methexis, participation. There is a sense in which differentiation and also similarity defines that ground. In short, from the notion of an upadhi as a limitation of a pre-existing set of semantic potentials, we get a way of defining ground as a field of infinite possible meanings that takes specific configurations, coming out of a nascent logic-based ontology. It's from that definition of the ground of reality that we get a divine defined as full in this deeper sense. As the Advaitin Sridhara Swami put it, Brahman is fullness, it's a revealing and concealing, and the world is merely the selective filter that passes over it at all times. So, last paragraph. What has been the moral of this story? I haven't looked at the more flamboyant puzzles of logic, as many people are doing later in the conference. It'd be exciting to go into the modal possibilities here, etc. I've simply tried to tell what historians might call quite a Whiggish history of philosophical progress, in which initial intuitions about inference as needing a causal ground generate an appearance and ground debate developed around the discovery of this notion and the desire to abductively infer something underlying it, which helps to make sense of the appearances we see in the world and their coherence. Early classical reflection on inductive inference and the nature of kinds, augmented by abductive reasoning towards explanations, inspires a kind of god of inference here. Through a tradition laced with healthy self-reflective skepticism about the reification of concepts into discrete entities, as we've seen coming from a number of sources, partly from the Buddhists, partly from the disappointment of Brahminical thinkers, into the way in which experience did not necessarily support their assumption that language corresponds naturally to the world. This gives a skepticism which helps to refine these ideas. And the implications of this for a logic-shaped god gradually emerged as the divine came to be redefined, in one tradition at least, as the sacred ground of logical form. It's worth noting that the creative impetus of abduction was necessary to carry over from reflection on inductive reasoning's insights and deductive reasoning's insight. So inductive reasoning notes that there must be a continuity that we need to give account of. Otherwise, as some of the Hindus argued against the Buddhists, if there was no ground, appearances would simply happen all the time. Rabbit, cake, person, blue, red, yellow. What is the underpinning continuity that allows identities to exist? The desire for this comes out of the notion of induction as something that they find fascinating. And deductive reasoning also plays its part in noticing that as soon as you start to unpack concepts dialectically, you end up with a kind of a dialectically defined underlying framework for what it is for something to exist as a particular thing. We no longer can have Plato's world of forms in which they sit discreetly. There must be a web of ideas on which things have relations constantly and diffuse identities. It's interesting, I think, the last statement. Abduction, of course, is the bad boy of philosophical inference. It's the thing that is irresponsible and I think has a bit of a bad name in modern logical reflection. So we can analyze texts. In fact, deduction has become perhaps one of the most important things attached to synthetic reasoning. This is what takes over formal logic. Peirce, and indeed people like Russell at the roots of modern logic in the Western University, are very skeptical about the kind of speculative, creative, imaginative philosophizing that generates metaphysics. And indeed, it's been noticed that metaphysics kind of underwent a rather a dark age in much of the 20th century. Some have tried to bring it back in the modern context. Indian thinkers were less cautious, perhaps because they didn't have a Descartes. They didn't have the same skeptical, they had much of skepticism, but they didn't have the same absolute commitment to certainty that I think shaped the Western tradition after the Renaissance and the Enlightenment periods. So that the metaphysical traditions of Vedanta, of, if you like, scholastic ontology, remained strong and vigorous in many ways. That's also, of course, because they had a strong religious motivation behind them. But that lack of speculative caution is perhaps one of the distinctive features of the Indian tradition. One of the reasons it does what it does that's so interesting ontologically, as happened in ancient Greece. Modern academic philosophy is much more cautious, but Laurie Patton has described early Hindu reflection in terms of a quest for mental power. And in these sources, logic serves as something that inspires creative thinking as well as cautious analysis. It serves as a divine gift, something secured by an underlying divine cause, something worthy of devotion in later texts, in some cases a mystical access to the ground of things, but in all cases something that was considered by these thinkers just as important as the blessings and the immortality that other forms of religion can bring.